The most gratifying thing about the film project is that Vietnam veterans, you know, they are not a monolithic group. I might have mentioned that. There is no monolith, but a lot of them look at the film as the real skinny from guys on the ground. You know, it's just, it's no BS. There's no politics. There's no opinions. It's just,
yeah,
that's good.
Well, I'd love to sit here and talk songwriting with you for another hour, but our time's running short. I have to mention your logo. I saw the on your website, the Buffalo Romeo logo, and it says "No more negative waves." Can you say a little bit more about that?
Well, that's both my personal credo at this point, and you know, my hope that we can all move together without creaming each other over our minor disagreements, and all work towards a higher goal that we all have, which is a better life for all of us here in the United States and in the world.
Amen. Well, keep up the good work. Do you have any plans to do another Swing States road show? I might want to join you on that one.
Leave that to somebody else this time around. Yeah.
Okay. No,
we're hitting the high road now. When they go low, we stay high.
My guest has been Lee Jones. His duo is called Buffalo Romeo. Look for him around town. And now he plays places like 16 Tons and Viking Braggot. I don't know. A few places here in Eugene.
Places like that.
Yeah. You've been listening to Train of Thought. My name's Rob Tobias. Thank you for listening. Till next time. Train of Thought can be heard on KEPW 97.3 in Eugene. It's also posted on soundcloud.com/RobTobias. For comments and suggestions, email rob@robtobias.com.
All right, Kathy, you want to give me your credentials? You're Kathy Guillermo with People for Ethical Treatment of Animals.
That's correct. And I've been with PETA for 30 years. I head up our laboratory investigations division, our horse racing division, and a few other areas.
Okay, and you're a biologist, or what? Or do you have a degree in anything? Or
I do have a degree. I have a degree in English with a minor in chemistry, and my expertise mostly comes from my experience and from my staff of scientists.
For 30 years with PETA. Okay. All right, so what is mostly tested on animals?
Well, there are a whole variety of different areas for animal testing, and the one we are primarily concerned with right now is what we call basic research, or what is called basic research, or curiosity-based testing. And with this, we're talking about experiments that are done in corporations, but quite a few in universities, much of it federally funded, and they're just experiments to see what happens when you do different things to animals. So it's not directly about what is going to cure a human being of something. It in no way really furthers human medicine, but it's just looking at, for example, how different parts of a brain in a monkey or a mouse or a rat works, what happens if you give a rat sepsis and then try various treatments on the animal, what happens when you show a monkey advertising and try to make some kind of a connection between how the monkey sees power in sex and advertising and how humans do, that kind of thing.
Right, but I thought a lot of it was done for cosmetics, too.
There is relatively little cosmetics testing in the United States now and in Europe, but it has shifted to China. And I think that's a testament to the power of the consumer. And people who have demanded over the last couple of decades cruelty-free cosmetics not tested on animals in any way. And so what we have seen is companies comply, and because they saw they had to comply, they came up with non-animal test methods that they could use instead. What hasn't happened is the embracing of those methods by China. And that's what we're working on right now, because we're still looking at 200,000 or so animals killed for cosmetics products that are sold in China.
Well, so boycotts seem to work. We just need to get the word out on the rest of the world. Go on.
That's everything. I mean, a boycott, a consumer demand, that is everything. That's what changed it in so much of the Western world. And companies are well aware that people don't want them to be testing products on animals in China, even if the government requires it. And that's why our list of companies that don't test on animals is so crucial to the consumer today.
So you have a list posted on your website?
Yes, we do. People can just go to PETA.org, and there's a box on the right-hand side, and it tells you how exactly to go to the database, and it's searchable by product type, by company, just about any way you need to find the information.
All right, so then other countries, this brings me to my next question. First of all, what is regulated in the United States on animal testing? Are there regulations here in the United States?
You know, that's such a good question, because I think if people who experiment on animals were to explain it, they would say it's highly regulated, but in fact, nothing could be further from the truth. There's only one federal law that deals with the use of animals in experiments. It's the Animal Welfare Act, and it deals primarily with housekeeping issues. How big should cages be? And, you know, it does require veterinary care. It does require painkillers unless there's some good reason not to have it. But it doesn't prohibit any experiment at all. So anything that an experimenter can think up that he can get his rubber stamp committee at the facility to okay, that's fine with the government. The other problem is, of course, that under the Federal Animal Welfare Act, mice and rats and birds are not even considered animals. So while mice and rats make up 95% of the animals used in laboratories, they have no protection under the law, the federal law at all.
And they certainly have feelings, just like any other animal. I mean, they're mammals, mice, right?
They are. You know, they're rodents, and they definitely have the same kinds of feelings that we see in other animals. And part of the reason we know this is that the scientific community has studied empathy in mice and rats. And we know, for example, that mice laugh when they're tickled, when they're babies especially, and they do this at levels that are inaudible to the human ear. We know that rats will risk their own lives to help other rats who are in danger. We've seen these tiny little animals who have little individual personalities, just as humans do, sacrifice themselves in order to help others. And whether those others are related to them or not doesn't seem to matter. They've gone hungry in order to provide food to other animals who are hungry. So it's quite remarkable, and I think anybody who's ever known a little mouse or a rat, because they've had one as a companion, can attest to this. They certainly have charming personalities and are individuals.
Well, so I know you want a ban on all animal testing, but is there a regulation that you could, what regulations, is there any regulations that you would be endorse or be happy with other than a complete ban?
Well, yes, we would like a ban. We think it's bad science, and we certainly think it's unethical. But yes, I would certainly be happy with something that would give the animals a little bit more protection or a lot more protection than they have now. I mean, for example, to include mice and rats and birds and lizards and even cows and horses, who are also not considered animals if they're being used in agricultural research, to include those under the Animal Welfare Act would be huge progress. And to require painkiller for animals, no matter what the circumstances are, that would be huge progress. To get rid of the obviously stupid experiments that we've seen, I was just looking at one last week done at Oregon Health and Science University on pair bonding in voles. Voles are small animals, you know, similar to rats, but very affectionate animals who bond for life with other voles. And this was an experiment to see what effect alcohol had on their pair bonding. Now, obviously, voles don't drink alcohol, and humans do. And this just seems really ridiculous to me that we're going to try to conclude anything about humans by tormenting the animals in this way.
You know, you mentioned Oregon. I know years ago they protested the UFO here was testing on monkeys, and I think they toned it down a little bit, but they're still testing on monkeys in most major universities. Is that right?
That's right, and at OHSU is the Oregon National Primate Research Center. It's part of OHSU, but it's federally funded, and there are thousands of monkeys at that facility. And in fact, I was recently in Oregon, in Portland, for our open records lawsuit because we had put in a public records request to obtain video from experiments on a paper that had already been published, and we were denied that open records request, so we took the university to court, and that we're still waiting on the decision for that, so we don't know whether we and the public have won or not, but these are experiments in which mother monkeys are fed diets high in fat. Their babies are taken from them, they're put in individual cages, and they're frightened with being stared at by a human, for example, which is very frightening for a monkey to stare at a monkey like that. Or they put a rubber snake in front of the cage, which is also frightening. Most primates are afraid of snakes and spiders, and they put spiders in front of the cage, or a Mr. Potato Head doll with great big eyes, which also frightens monkeys. So these are the kinds of videotapes that we were hoping to get, because the university does control its own message through its press releases and through its published papers. Well, let's see the whole picture.
Well, and that's a state-sponsored institution, right? It's not even a private one.
That's correct.
That's our tax dollars that are paying for that.
That's right.
Right, so I take it, so other countries' regulations are basically non-existent in China and especially the third world.
There are many places with no or very poor regulations involving use of animals in laboratories. That's correct. We see in the European Union, they're in some ways a little bit better than they are in the United States, but there is a range. I think we as the United States, which funds more experiments on animals than any other country in the world, certainly has the obligation to set a better standard for the world. And that seems to me the very least we could do. I think we also have to look at the fact that animal experiments are not actually helping humans. If we look back at how they have not led to treatments and cures, no matter how you feel about animals, there's a very good reason not to be trying to find answers out about human disease through another species.
Well, and so military, we don't know what they're doing at all.
We do have some idea. They are to some degree also subject to the Freedom of Information Act requests. We have worked for many years to end the shooting and stabbing of pigs and goats in medic training for the military, and we have, I'm very happy to say, ended that in the Coast Guard with that branch of the DOD, and it has been reduced by about 95% across the rest of the military. So we do know that. Strangely enough, under the Department of Defense rules, they actually do include mice and rats in their oversight. So while they shouldn't be using animals at all, at least those little animals do have some benefit in the military.
All right, and so you touched a little bit, you want to elaborate on the conditions in the facilities where these animals are tested?
You know, I think that's what's so shocking when one sees video from inside these facilities. If you look at video from the Oregon National Primate Research Center, for example, at OHSU, and at any of the National Primate Research Centers, some of the monkeys are not housed together or in groups, many of them, in fact, across the country. But the size of their cages is so appalling. I mean, it's like if you took a phone booth and cut it in half. That's about how much space. And I guess we don't really have phone booths anymore, but it's maybe, 2 feet by 3 feet by 3 feet. And this 30-pound or 25 or 30-pound animal is spending virtually all their time inside that cage. There's nothing to do. There's nothing to look at but through the door of that cage at the wall on the opposite side. The housing conditions are just so substandard for what an animal needs. And this is really true across all species. Mice and rats, of course, are in little plastic boxes that are stacked one atop another. Dogs may be in small runs, or they may be in cages. Some laboratories still have cages hanging on walls that dogs are in. So there is virtually nothing in the environment that these animals are housed in that meet their social or emotional or psychological needs.
And this could go on for years, this isn't just months. They might be there for years.
They are. And, you know, we had done an undercover investigation at the Oregon Primate Center about 10 years ago or so, 10 or 11 years ago, and that we had video footage of some of the monkeys in there, and a former employee at the Primate Center who had 6 or 7 years before that released a video of what he found disturbing when he was working there, actually recognized some of those monkeys. So, yes, year after year after year, they can be sitting in these cages.
And so where do they get these monkeys? And where do they get all the animals, but especially the monkeys?
Right. For most of the animals are bred by companies that specialize in this. Charles River Lab is one example of that. And they're purchased, just like test tubes or beakers that you would put in a laboratory. Monkeys can be either bred at the facility. That's kind of rare. That's less common than with other species because it's expensive to breed monkeys. So many monkeys are still actually imported from either caught in the wild or from a dealer who has caught monkeys from their own homes and then bred them and then sold the offspring. So they may be shipped from Mauritius or from China. They may have come from Vietnam or other Asian countries into the United States.
Well, so this corporation, though, that you're talking about is basically a medical supply company. So you're literally looking at a catalog of equipment that includes test animals.
That's exactly what it is. You go online or you look at a catalog and you put your order in. And if you look at a company like Jackson Laboratory in Maine, which specializes in genetically engineered mice, you can order so-called animal models that have a certain genetic makeup. So they're very much manipulated in that way and without question sold as a commodity to be used in a laboratory.
Well, then, what, they're kept frozen, or their genes are kept frozen until they're needed? Is that the way that works?
With Jackson Laboratory, they are able to freeze some of the genetic material to be used in certain ways, and they also sell the live animals who've been bred to behave in a certain way or to have certain traits.
But I mean, they don't just keep these animals when they're not needed, don't they breed them as they're needed, as there's a call for the animal?
Yeah, it's both. It really is both. And one of the interesting things we've seen happen because of the coronavirus, the COVID-19 outbreak in the United States, is that many universities have closed and they have reduced the number of workers who can come into the facility. They obviously have to have somebody come in to do some feeding and watering and cleaning, but they have ordered, many universities have ordered that so-called excess or extraneous animals be destroyed, which of course makes me ask, why were there any extra? You know, they have said you will terminate all non-essential research projects. Well, why were any non-essential research projects being conducted in the first place? We're talking about caging and manipulating and harming other living beings. How could it be done in any other way than absolutely essential? But clearly that's not the case.
Yeah. All right. So that brings me, you mentioned the COVID virus. So that brings me to what these markets that are in cities. I noticed on your website you're talking about the New York City market. There's actually a market in New York City of live animals, but let's stick with the Chinese one. These are wild animals that are in the Chinese market, right?
That's right. Yes, and they're wild animals who are caught and sold and consumed.
And how much of that do you suppose is poverty, though? These people are trying to make a living. Not that that's any defense, but I'm just saying a lot of that is due to the poverty in these areas is the reason they're going out and procuring and capturing these animals.
I'm sure there is something to that. I think, however, that if there were no market for selling them, then it wouldn't be an income stream. You know, in other words, if people were not really willing to buy them in the market, then other people wouldn't be catching them and selling them. And I think what we've seen now is that it is not simply a matter of life and death for the animals, but for the human population as well. So there have to be some serious steps taken. We've gone to the World Health Organization and asked them to call for a closure of these laboratories, or excuse me, not laboratories, but live animal markets, and that I would think China would be the country that would want to lead in that effort.
And so what are the conditions in these markets?
Well, they're abysmal, and they're abysmal not just in China, but in any country where there are live markets, including in the United States. And what we see are wild animals who have been either captured from their homes and gone straight to market, or captured from their homes and shipped to another country where they will be made available for sale. And they're stuck in small cages. Cages are stacked one on top of another. And this is suspected in the transmission of this virus among species in the Wuhan market, is that it is postulated that perhaps one animal species stacked on top of another, so the waste falls through, the virus is transmitted, eventually it goes to people. But, you know, there's no food, there's no water. They're just stacked in these cages until they're sold, slaughtered probably badly, and then eaten.
And most of them, the exotic ones, are for some weird cure that has never been proven. It's probably based in a wives' tale.
Well, there is a tradition of Chinese medicine that I think has some validity to it, and I'm not talking about animals, so I'm talking about herbs.
Right,
and,
yeah.
You know, but I think that in the case of the wild animals, it's either just for the palate, just because people want the taste of it, or if there is some belief in that it is medicinal, that's certainly not something that's been proven.
Right, so how accurate is animal testing, and what are the alternatives?
Well, that's been something that we have stated for a long time. Let me put it another way. We've been deeply concerned for decades, not only about the animals, and that, frankly, has been our primary concern, but about the fact that we aren't seeing a whole lot of cures come out of the use of animals in experimentation. And over the last decade, the studies examining how effective animals are in these experiments have shown what really should no longer be denied. So if you just look at the statistics from our own government, the National Institutes of Health states very clearly that 95% of new medications that test safe and effective in animals then fail in human trials. So we're creating a disease model, perhaps not even the disease itself, since animals don't get many of the diseases we have in the human population. And then we're creating a cure for that disease or disease model in another species, so it's really not surprising that 95% of the time it doesn't work in humans. But if you look at any area of business or, any area where we are trying to help other human beings or trying to succeed, if you've got a 95% failure rate, you have to begin looking at what's wrong. And what's wrong is that we're studying the wrong disease in the wrong species.
Some people have been killed because of this, too, that was a mistake, that it didn't work in the human, and it was with dire consequences.
That's right. Even when sometimes it has been shown to be safe in animals, it's gone on to harm humans. And I could add to the, in addition to the 95% failure rate of overall of new medications, of that 5% that does go on to human clinical trials, half of that has to be withdrawn because it had adverse effects or simply didn't work. So we're really looking at a 97, 98% failure rate. And if you look at some disease areas, for example, neurological diseases like Alzheimer's, Parkinson's disease, and stroke, if you look at some of these specific disease areas, the failure rate on medications developed in animals is 98, 99, and 100% in human beings. So, I think the evidence is pretty clear. What we're doing is not working. Another set of scientists took a look at where the basic research that I referred to earlier, if that's taking us anywhere. So, for example, you're studying physiology, or you're looking at different parts of the brain of an animal. Where does all that basic research lead? Well, the answer is that 90% of it leads nowhere. 90% of it does not result in therapies for humans. So, again, we're looking at what is a failed model. And what we need is for our government, which funds so much of it, and our university systems, which are relying on the grants for these experiments, to acknowledge what is so obvious here.
Well, who are the grants coming from?
Most of the grants from the that go to university experiments come from the National Institutes of Health. It has about a $40 billion budget, and about half of that budget is going to animal experiments, and many of them at universities across the country and some universities around the world.
Well, and so, but there's computer models that they can use, and what are the alternatives?
Well, that's the amazing thing. I mean, we have seen a huge growth in the non-animal market now. Yeah, and you're absolutely right. There are incredible computer models now where you can put in the properties of particular chemicals or substances or medications, and you can get a very good prediction about how it's going to react in humans. The fairly new organs on a chip, they're called, where these are 3D tissue models, and they can be used for testing various medications. You can grow human skin practically by the yard now for testing certain things. I mean, the sophistication in the non-animal test market is really amazing right now. What we need, I think, is the acknowledgement that we have to put the money toward this, not only using what is already available, but seeing what else we can develop. And, I mean, I know people who work at some of these companies where, for example, they are developing the organs on a chip, and they're trying to get the government and the pharmaceutical companies to run side-by-side comparison tests so that if they have to run an animal experiment, at least use the non-animal method and compare the information. Because the obvious question about the failure, you know, that is raised from the failure of animal experiments is not only that we've developed something that doesn't work, but what are we missing? What are we missing because it didn't work in humans? Or in animals, excuse me, but might work in humans.
Mm-hmm. Well, and their argument, though, is that the animals have receptors. I noticed they use various animals because one animal doesn't have the correct receptor that the other one does. But really, do any of the animals have the same receptors that we do?
You know, it's such a good question. You cannot turn a mouse into a tiny human, and you cannot even turn a monkey into a tiny human. As much as we share emotionally with these animals and in terms of what our needs are as living beings, physiologically, they're just different from us and from each other. And I think one way to think about this is that there has been, over the last couple of decades, a real question raised about the fact that so many of the clinical studies have been on men. And so that generated a certain information that wasn't necessarily applicable to women. And so there has been an increase in the number of clinical studies involving human women so that we get full information. So if you think that think about this for a moment, that there are big differences between men and women of the same species, then how is it we think we're going to learn a lot from a rat or a rabbit or a pig?
Mm-hmm. Well, so, all right, so it just occurs to me, though, now, you're saying that the pharmaceutical companies, that they don't do the testing, that it's our tax dollars through the National Institutes of Health that do this. So, A, I don't know if you can answer this question, but A, why don't the pharmaceutical companies, they don't seem to want to spend the money on this stuff, first of all, and would they spend the money if on it, or would they find some other way to do it if our tax dollars weren't paying for this?
Right. That is such a good question, and I think this is at the crux of so much of the work that our scientists at PETA do. The fact is that when you're looking at a corporation, whether it's a chemical corporation or a pharmaceutical corporation or a cosmetic or whatever, they don't have any interest in perpetuating something that might not work. So, for example, you have a university that gets grant money, they do a study, they publish the study, they get tenure. That's a motivation for a university to continue with an old paradigm. But we've done a lot of work with chemical companies to move away from the use of animals. And we have sponsored the development of non-animal methods. We've worked with chemical companies to go to the U.S. government to remove requirements for certain tests that have saved millions of animals. We're beginning to do some of this work with pharmaceutical companies now, too. The pharma companies do use a lot of animals, partly because they're still used in research and development, but also because our government still requires toxicity testing and efficacy testing on animals. That's got to change. But you're quite right that there's no particular desire on the part of a pharmaceutical company to continue to use animals if it's not working. They also need to move into this new way of looking at science and understanding that they might actually have a lot better success if they weren't relying on animals.
Well, so there's something we can do is tell the FDA to stop requiring that drugs be tested on animals before they can pass through the FDA. Is that what you're saying?
That's exactly right, and I think that has to be done. And you know, we've begun to do a bit of work on some of the tests that are so obviously poor. For example, there's something called a forced swim test, and it's, you know, I don't know if that sounds bad or not, but it certainly is bad. You take a beaker, you fill it with water. You take a mouse or a hamster or a rat or a gerbil or another little animal, and you put that animal in the water. There's no place for them to stand or escape or rest or get out of the water. So they swim frantically and thinking they're going to drown. At some point, you know, after they're done panicking, they figure out that they can stop and float. And most of them will do this after they've reached the point of exhaustion. They don't really have much choice but to try to float. Now, believe it or not, this is supposed to be a test to measure the effectiveness of an antidepressant drug. And the idea is that, you know, if a mouse swims for a long time, that mouse is not depressed. But I know, it's truly laughable. But if the mouse floats, then the mouse is depressed and the drug hasn't worked. Well, obviously, once an animal learns he can float, he's going to float. So this is an adaptive behavior. So this is quite a controversial test, even among scientists and in their own community. So we began to go to the pharmaceutical companies. We tracked all their published papers. We found that some of the big pharma companies were subjecting thousands of animals to this test in the search for an antidepressant. So two things came out of this. One is that they came up with no antidepressants. I mean, and this is, well, we were talking about some of the biggest pharma companies in a decade, thousands of animals, no drug for humans. And so we started going to them. We went to Johnson & Johnson and Bayer and Bristol-Myers Squibb and Pfizer. And so far we've gotten about 13 of these companies to ban the forced swim test. And I think that's so key. This is the first time we've ever been able to persuade a pharmaceutical company to ban a particular type of test. And once the pharmaceutical companies are doing this, then we believe that the government agencies will take a serious look at it. So it's a beginning of a long process that we're involved in. But eventually, this needs to be every medication, every test. You know, it needs to be tested in a way that's meaningful to people, that doesn't harm animals, and that's going to really represent the best science that we have.
Because it kind of sounds like how we used to have to find witches in Salem, kind of a medieval.
That's so true.
And that didn't work very well either. So it just occurs to me, are you guys doing institutional investors and going to shareholders of these companies and appealing to shareholders and people who invest in these companies?
We are, and in fact, that's how we got some of these companies to the negotiating table, was by introducing a resolution calling for the company to ban the forced swim test. And once we were then able to sit around the table with the scientists, and sometimes it was virtual over the phone, so metaphorically speaking, sit around the table, once we could have this discussion with them, then they began to agree. And we currently have a resolution in front of Eli Lilly, which so far has been unwilling to have a discussion about this at all.
So that's a stockholder meeting that you guys are attending, right? Is how you're doing a shareholder resolution is what you're describing.
Yes, that's exactly right. And what we have done is buy the minimum amount of stock required in order to bring a resolution. Mm-hmm. So I believe that's $2,000 worth of stock right now. So we own a minimal amount, or we work with shareholders who agree with us, who are willing to bring the resolution with us.
So there's a good reason to donate money to Capita right there. All right, so on your website, you talk about Johns Hopkins Labs. What are they doing to I think it's primates that they're abusing at Johns Hopkins?
They're an equal opportunity abuser. And Johns Hopkins is a private university, so they are not subject to open records requests. It's very difficult to get information out of them. But the experiments that we are protesting in particular involve owls. And I believe the monkeys that you're referring to, Johns Hopkins was in trouble recently with the U.S. Department of Agriculture for violations of the Animal Welfare Act for their treatment of some of the monkeys in their care. But we're looking specifically at a study involving barn owls. And there is an experimenter there who, and I know this will sound unbelievable to you, but this person is getting a couple $1 million for this. He has these barn owls. He saws into their skulls, removes a part of the skull, and he puts a metal rod, a sort of an attachment on there so that their head can be fastened in place. Then he puts these barn owls in devices that are a little bit like straight jackets, and he puts them in position for an experiment in which he has either headphones on them, and so sounds are blasting to their ears, or they're staring at a screen with dots going by on it, and he puts different tiny, very tiny hair-like electrodes down into portions of their brain, and he takes readings from their brains as they listen to the sounds or look at the screen. And I'm not kidding about that.
Yeah,
I know.
And owls have very sensitive eyes and very sensitive ears. So I would imagine that's not very comfortable for an owl.
I think it must be miserable. I think the whole thing from start to finish is an atrocity. And what you said about their acute hearing and their vision is exactly Johns Hopkins' excuse for studying them. They're saying, well, these are animals who can focus in on an object at night from a big distance away. So therefore, maybe they can tell us something about attention deficit disorder in children.
Well, that seems a long way to go. It seems like they could do much more with some other type of research, maybe with children that have ADD instead of animals.
That would be the logical, and there, you know, of course, now there are non-invasive, non-painful ways to study human brains that can be used, and the information gathered would be directly relevant to humans. And in fact, these studies are going on. There are people studying attention deficit disorder in human beings without harming the human beings, doing it with full cooperation, and getting results that are directly relevant to human beings.
Right. So, and then Texas A&M is using dogs.
Yes. You know, this came to our attention a couple of years ago because somebody from inside the laboratory gave us a video of the golden retrievers and some other breeds of dogs. They had been bred specifically to develop a form of canine muscular dystrophy, and they have been studied for about 30 years now. Since 2012 at Texas A&M. And, you know, it's a really horrible disease in dogs, just as it is in human beings, because they become very physically incapacitated, very difficult for them to walk, their muscles contract, their tongues enlarge. They sit in these kennels, and this is what our video shows, with these long strings of saliva from their jaws because they really can't swallow like a normal dog. And they have to eat, the only food that they can get down is a kind of a porridge, you know, a very runny gruel type food. And so when we got this video, our scientists did a good look at the literature and we spoke to other experts, and this hasn't led to anything to help human beings. That's the thing. you know, 30 years of these experiments and people with muscular dystrophy are still waiting for treatments. There is one medication, well, there are several medications that are in trials right now, in clinical trials, one of which Texas A&M claims that it assisted with, but it's been put on a hold because of adverse reaction in humans. So we have been urging the university to shut this laboratory down and put this money into something that would be more effective. And we've made some progress. They've stopped breeding the dogs because they, what they would do is they would keep the dogs who were born with the gene but didn't develop the disease, and they would use those to breed to create more research models, basically. Mm-hmm. So they've stopped the breeding. The lab has gone from about 100 dogs down to about 30 dogs right now, and we're trying to get them to shut it down entirely and release those dogs. We've offered to take all of the dogs, find them decent homes for whatever time they have left. And so far, we have been ignored. But just to give you an idea of how strong the feeling is, 500 physicians have joined us in requesting an end to these experiments. And 100 of those doctors treat people with muscular dystrophy. They treat children who have the disease. And so they know how useless this is. We have people who have muscular dystrophy who oppose this for both ethical reasons and scientific reasons. So at this point, I think Texas A&M is just trying not to let us call victory, because I don't think that they have any funding for experiments, and I think they just need to give up and let these dogs go.
All right, so I'm headed towards wrapping up if there's anything else you want to say, but I got a strange question for you that I've been pondering myself is support animals, these emotional support animals, on the one hand, I mean, this is where animals are great, is because we need a relationship with animals, so that's fine. But I'm wondering if people are just using is there a point at which people are just using animals? I mean, I know a spider is not an animal, but I mean, having an emotional support spider that you need to get a better seat on an airplane, is there a line that we're crossing with the emotional support animals?
You know, I think there can be, and I think it very much depends on the individual situations. I would say with any wild animal, I think we pretty much know that those animals don't want to be in that situation, and that should not be allowed. You know, with any non-domestic animal, that should just be cut off right there. And I think even sometimes with the dogs I've seen, I mean, you know, again, it depends on the situation. I have seen, you know, wonderful dogs who are very bonded to their human being, provide help, and they in turn are cared for beautifully and loved. And I've seen animals abused in this situation too. I mean, physically hit, struck. So, you know, I think there becomes, at any point where we have animals in our lives, it is good to evaluate that. I mean, we certainly are in favor of companion animals and, you know, don't buy the dog or cat. Go to a shelter and adopt one. But if you can, share your home with the dog and cat, because there are so many who need them. But at some point, yes, I think it can turn from love and respect into exploitation.
When I have trouble, I try not to make a judgment about this, but when I see a person with a really big dog that they're in an apartment building, I'm hoping that they've rescued the dog and that the dog's better off that way, but I really have trouble seeing someone with a large dog in an apartment building. But also, it just reminds me, too, and again, I'm going to wrap this up, is, you know, now we're having this financial crisis, and in the 2008 financial crisis, I know, I don't want to get into my story, but I was in Watts, and there were all kinds of dogs down there that people just let their dogs loose, and I rescued one that had been its legs were hurting, were not developing properly. It was a puppy, a little larger than a puppy, and its legs weren't developing. So I fed it and got it going, and I had to give it away. But anything? Have you got anything on what's going to happen, you suppose, with this financial crisis and animals?
Well, first of all, thank you for that, because when we see the suffering, we need to do something about it. PETA has a hotline. You can go on to PETA.org. If you see animal suffering, you can certainly call our are number for reports of abuse and animals in terrible situations, that we have somebody on that phone 24 hours a day, 365 days a year. But yes, we always worry when a situation becomes dire financially, what is going to happen to the animals and people's lives? And especially at this point when we see some shelters have not been able to stay open. I think the communities, every community needs to have an open admission animal shelter. And by open admission, I mean they need to take every dog and cat who comes in. They can't turn them away because they don't have enough space or because they don't have enough homes. There has to be a place for animals to go. And certainly we hope that with the current financial situation that it doesn't get too much worse than we're seeing now and that people can manage to take care of their animals. But if they can't, they certainly are responsible for making sure that animal is not abandoned or is not put in a situation that is not good. The last thing I'll say about that is it's so wonderful for dogs and cats right now because their humans are home all day. Yeah. So they're getting a bit of a treat here.
All right. So how do we support people for ethical treatment of animals?
Well, that's very kind of you. They can go to, anybody listening can go to PETA.org, and there's all kinds of instructions there, all kinds of information, first of all, about what I've talked about and all kinds of other issues, too, and about the live animal markets, about experimentation and the kinds of things that we've been talking about. And there's a donation form there, too, if people want to support. We do appreciate it.
All right, Kathy Guillermo from People with Ethical Treatment of Animals. Thank you for all your good work, and I hope you keep it up.
Thank you very much for having me on. I appreciate it.
All right. Goodbye.
Bye-bye.
Are you going to do like a station ID or something?
Yeah, that's what I was trying to hang up her phone, but I guess we can't. So, KEPW 97.3 FM. Eugene Peaceworks Community Radio. Thank you all for listening. So that did go over very well. And just one thing I want to say, that Jana's been doing a fantastic job of the news. I hope you listen to the news every day on KEPW 97.3 FM. And one of the things she said was that environmental regulations have been lifted for all leaders and corporations because of this financial meltdown. And we are all just appalled at that. And it's always the environment that suffers, and usually women, children, and the environment are always what suffers when corporations go berserk and our government sponsors multinational corporations. All right, so I'm going to end it early a little bit, so it should go to Northwest Music Mix. And check out Dr. Zoom tomorrow on Sunday, and you'll hear... we play Northwest music. We support local musicians here on KEPW 97.3. So I'm going to give it over to them. All right, and thank you, Nan, for all you do, Nan and Rick, at the station.
You're welcome.
So long.
Thank you. Ciao.
Support independent media. Tell your friends.